Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to focus on cancer with one of the outstanding luminaries in this field. He's Dr. Barry Boyd, and Dr. Boyd is at Greenwich Hospital, where he has developed a specific program, an unusual program, in integrative oncology. That's momentous news because Greenwich Hospital is part of the prestigious Yale New Haven Health Network, and it is certainly a sign of the times that a doctor like Dr. Barry Boyd is able to pull this off in an academic setting. His specialty is medical oncology. Of course, he's trained in internal medicine, and he has an interest in the treatment and prevention of cancer. His medical education, he's a graduate of Cornell University Medical College, and that's where he did his residency. And without further ado, here's Dr. Barry Boyd. It's a pleasure having you on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You were a guest a few years back on Health Talk, on my regular network radio program.
Yeah, that's right, Ron. And interestingly, between then and now, I had actually taken a four-year break to develop and run the nutrition curriculum at the Yale Medical School. So I actually created and ran that for 4 years until they revised the curriculum. But I was fortunate to be able to learn more than I taught. So there's nothing like that.
That's an interesting segue because, you know, we often hear criticisms of the minimal role that nutrition plays in the curriculum of medical students. I mean, did you find it a daunting and frustrating task to introduce elements of medical education into doctors' training programs?
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting, the experience I had. The first year, I had a very enthusiastic group of medical students who couldn't leave me alone. You know, I would get questions for an hour after every lecture. They were very enthusiastic supporters, and they kind of got it. And it's like every medical school class has their own personality. And then some of the subsequent classes were really just interested in telling me what the questions to the answers to the questions
sort
on,
of a cynical
approach. The exam are. And to be fair, they're overwhelmed with a volume of information. And so much of medicine is molecular biology and pharmacology. But, you know, the lessons I was teaching them were that nutrition is the glue that holds it all together. And the more I actually had to literally review every single aspect of nutrition. I didn't just teach about cancer, but I taught nutrition and diabetes, nutrition and cardiovascular disease. I taught about prenatal influences of nutrition on development. And I had my favorite lecture of all, Ron, was The Origins of Western Disease and the Evolution of the American Diet.
Wow.
And it truly was, and what it was interestingly, and I think everyone will, this is a good segue into cancer, because I took everything that had been reported am I blocking on his name suddenly? I had the tip of my tongue. The great Michael Pollan, who had written about food and what he had described as the mythology about nutritionism. And I use that to explore the scientific understanding of how the American diet has changed often with inadequate or misinformation. And every time we would come out with new nutrition guidelines for the country, they were really based on just the beginnings of an understanding of nutrition. We made huge errors. Like everybody went on a low-fat diet in the late 70s based on the McGovern Commission, and that led to diabetes and obesity and all of the things that were a consequence of that. And it was really great to take his book and turn it into and really develop the science behind what had happened to the American diet. So it was, for me, fun. And needless to say, the curriculum committee decided, no, we need a lecture on carbohydrate, protein, and fat.
Right.
So let's eliminate that lecture. And yet I think the students learned the most from that one historical, you know, bit of understanding nutrition evolution in America.
Yeah, and you know, things haven't changed that much since we went to medical school. When they devoted, I don't know, maybe 4 or 6 hours or perhaps 8 hours to strict nutrition lectures. And the reason for change is not because they're not interested in that. It's just that the curriculum is so crowded with requirements to learn about diseases and drugs and abnormal cells, and that it somehow gets pushed out of the way, even when it's a very, very
critical
importance. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is a mistake is, and one of the things we were trying to do, and I still hope we're working, and I still do teach some of the curriculum, is to integrate it within the context of the other fields. So it's no longer a separate subject, but there's nutrition and cardiovascular disease within the cardiovascular module. I do one or two lectures in the oncology module at the medical school. But, you know, it does teach people and the medical students that nutrition is not, oh, by the way, type of subject, but it's really central to everything you learn. And the paradox is that we're so pharmacologically based, and yet we all know the biggest complaint patients have is, what do I do about diet to prevent disease and to live longer so I don't need medications? And yet it's often lacking. And that's really central to everything we should be teaching.
Well, we had a conversation, it must have been, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, perhaps more, about your book, The Cancer Recovery Plan. And in that book, you outlined sensible steps to take if you want to prevent cancer or if you've had cancer, how to prevent a recurrence. What insights have you gained in the past decade or so? Do you have any new or reinforced beliefs since then?
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating things that I have, and the way I put this into the context, is really take apart the field of epidemiology in cancer. And that is, how do we look at evidence that determines the relationship between what people do and their risk of getting a disease? And how do we look at that evidence in relationship to survival so that we can take that and apply it to large numbers of people to help them live better? And so I take it from that as a beginning. I then also superimpose on that the understanding of the molecular biology, the deep science that explains the epidemiology. What I mean is, if you take, and I'll use as an example, the relationship between diet and lifestyle and risk of cancer, and the way we used to look at it is, well, what's the difference between an Asian woman and an American woman, and why don't they get the same level of breast cancer that we do? And, of course, those were the first ways to study it, and everybody said it must be the fat, because they have low-fat diet, and we have high-fat diet.
That's the whole Colin Campbell theory, you know, the China study.
And that's actually protein. I actually can explain that, too, because I think even there, there's a glimmer of how that really works. Because what I want to know is, what happens when people do this? You know, what are the outcomes of people, large numbers of people, with these types of dietary changes in their survival and risk? Because to me, that's the gold standard, right? I mean, it's not a hypothesis based on animals in a laboratory or based on tissues in a culture, but what when real people do this? I just had a blog in the Huffington Post on soy. And what was really interesting, soy is the paradigm for this understanding. You know, it was that Asian women, well, it must be the soy. So maybe it's the soy.
Be having soy shakes. If you have breast cancer, make sure you eat a lot of soy.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, then what followed, of course, was that soy was as we dissected it, as is typical for American science, we then decided we would take apart the soy and find out what's magic in there, and then we can put it in a capsule or a drug.
Right.
And so we dissected it, discovered that they contain compounds called isoflavones that are low molecular weight proteins that are very similar to estrogen, and they have this estrogen-like activity. And then culture studies were done in animals, and then all of a sudden people started to worry. So, well, you know, maybe soy is actually the opposite. Never mind that the original hypothesis was that high soy consuming populations have low breast cancer risk. I mean, everybody forgot about that, right? And then the concern was, well, soy will interfere with tamoxifen. So, and then a few studies were done that actually in animals showed that very high levels of these compounds could interfere with tamoxifen and might even make cells grow faster if they're breast cancer cells. And that led to, again, the same kind of guidelines. Based on these tissue culture and animal studies, you should stop eating soy. Women still understand that. Now, I don't want to get into the GMO issue, which is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm. That's another issue entirely, yes.
Yes, but the real simple question is, what happens when large numbers of women consume soy, right? And the way we look at that is what we call cohort studies. You follow a large population at the very beginning, diagnosed with breast cancer, you say, okay, I'm going to follow these thousands of women over a period of 7, 8, or 9 years, and let's determine what happens to them based on their soy intake. They're all various stages of breast cancer, early stage. They don't have metastatic disease. These are women who have been theoretically treated for their breast cancer, and it's not present. Many of them are on hormone therapy. Many aren't. And what happens, what's the good news about trying to get at these answers for cancer is we now are seeing these very large population studies where we can carefully dissect the diet and lifestyle and determine what the outcome is in these women, because we have thousands and thousands of women in these large long-term studies. It's like the Framingham study for heart disease that sorted out the cholesterol. Well, we have three studies in the U.S. and one study in Asia, and these large cohort studies, and every one of them showed uniformly the same thing. Increasing levels of soy had no negative impact on recurrence.
Right. And yet, I have to say that this is, you know, one of the most hot and heavy questions among my listeners and patients is soy protective, or is it going to give me, is it going to make my cancer explode? And the answer is that there may be a slight protective effect, if any.
That's right. And actually, what's really interesting is in two out of the three studies, there was two in the U.S. It was the LACE study, which is Life After Cancer Epidemiology Study from the West Coast. There was this very large cohort within a trial called the WELL study, Women's Healthy Eating Study. And the third was the Shanghai Breast Study, which was women who on average consume far more soy than American women because that's their culture. But in both cases, I mean, in all three studies, they showed no risk, and in two out of three, there was actually a reduction in recurrence risk. Now, one of the things about these long-term studies is it's reassuring that it's not going to raise your risk of either getting recurrence or dying, and that both of those were impacted, recurrence risk and mortality, not in a negative way. I mean, they actually turned out to be potentially beneficial. If the one thing we can't say is it's absolutely the soy that leads to a lower recurrence risk, because there may be other things that are common to soy consumers that may be actually the real reason they do well, but it's reassuring that they don't do worse.
Right. I mean, yeah, whenever you're doing epidemiological studies, I mean, for example, a study that might show that the more animal protein you consume, the lower your risk of heart disease. The question comes up, maybe these people are more affluent, maybe they get to see the doctors
yes,
more
exactly.
frequently, they're taking
right.
better care of themselves and so on. So,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
always these other effects in these big studies. But, you know, you mentioned something interesting earlier. You said, when we talked about the China study, you said maybe it's the protein.
Well, the China study, and let me kind of reflect on T. Colin Campbell's work.
Sure.
You know, he had looked at the increased incidence of cancers with increasing protein, animal protein intake, looking at the difference in Chinese population who develop hepatocellular cancer, because they have a disproportionately high level of liver cancer.
Which is an unusual cancer in America.
Yes, it is. And it's really, you know, and that's the intriguing thing about cancers is they're very population specific in the sense that some have very high risk. And theirs is largely because they have a very high incidence of hepatitis B, which is really a potentiator of liver cancer. In Africa, it's the contaminant in peanuts called aflatoxin. In the U.S., it's cirrhosis due to alcohol disease and too much iron overload. There are a whole host of reasons why we get it in the U.S. and hepatitis C, as well as fatty liver. You know, it's an intriguing thing that's turning out to be a leading cause of chronic liver disease and a secondary risk for cirrhosis. But at any rate, within China, it was largely related to this virus, and they had much more higher levels of this, so they had much higher levels of liver cancer than we do here. And when he looked at the epidemiology, he noted the relationship between dietary protein seeming to play a role in increasing risk. He went back to the laboratory at Cornell and looked at various things that could activate or enhance the carcinogenesis of the virus in culture and in animals, and showed that it was protein and specifically casein. And so his argument has been that, you know, and many people would argue that dietary animal protein is a potentiator of cancer risk. And I have a very different view of the epidemiology of this, how we look at large population risk, and it gets to the thing I was mentioning before we talked originally. You know what dietary protein early in childhood is responsible for? It's the biggest single enhancer of childhood growth.
Right.
Increasing both increasing
consumption. The limiting factor on growth. So if there's
yes.
starvation, you're going to have a stunted population, and we
yes.
see with each succeeding generation, they're getting taller and taller.
And my own interest has been, as part of, as I mentioned in my first lecture at Yale, how can we explain the rapid changes in risks in modern populations? We know that cancer, modern, what we call modern cancers, breast, colon, prostate, pancreas, colorectal, as well as other cancers, are much more common in modern times than they were 100 years ago. And it's not on an age, when you adjust it for age, it turns out that the risk is still higher. People used to say, well, it's because we live longer. That's true, but even if you look at people who are 60 now versus 60 then, our risk is far greater. I mean, one of the most interesting examples of this is people with a hereditary breast cancer gene have an 80% risk of getting breast cancer by the age of 85, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at the genes, which were no less common 100 years ago, they didn't suddenly pop up in Ashkenazi Jewish people. And the other large population with a high risk of a gene is actually the Inuits in Greenland have the highest level of a breast cancer gene of anywhere known.
Huh.
But what's intriguing is their risk of getting breast cancer 100 years ago was one-fifth what it is now.
Okay, so we're dealing with, I mean, the magic word here is epigenetics.
Yes, and environment.
The expression of gene and environment, right.
Yeah, so the environment somehow has taken a risky gene, like the BRCA gene, and turned it into a super risky gene. You know, so they could live to be 80, and their risk of getting breast cancer was only 20%. Now it's 85%.
Mm-hmm.
Truly amazing, and yet nobody ever talks about that. But I think that this is where we can modify survival and one of the and risk. So one of the issues about the Colin Campbell and animal protein is one of the most uniform findings in modern populations is better intake of foods, higher calories, and robust growth in childhood. And it turns out that robust childhood growth is actually the beginnings of the risk of modern Western cancers. Okay, now people say to me, how could good childhood lead to higher cancer risk? It's a simple thing I call the lottery ticket effect. When you get really good growth in childhood, children grow taller and they grow healthier. It turns out that the height of populations is directly proportional to socioeconomic status, longevity, and better survival and reduced cardiovascular risk. But a uniform finding in every population studied is increasing height is directly related to higher cancer risks. It's fascinating.
Right.
And what does that mean? Well, what is really happening is early in childhood and even prenatally, it's not actually epigenetics. It's a simple growth factor. As you develop more robust growth, you make more stem cells in every tissue. So you simply, it's I call it the lottery ticket effect, you simply are buying more lottery tickets for cancer later on.
More things can go awry eventually.
If you have 10% more cells, stem cells in every tissue, and those stem cells are the origins of cancer, a single mutation in one of those cells in your teens or 20s, and there are more of them there to be mutated, it takes only one of those cells over a period of years to make the right combination of mutations over a period of 30 or 40 years to evolve into a cancer. And so it's the beginnings. It's what I call pre-initiation. It's not the mutation. It doesn't cause cancer. It simply lays the groundwork for a larger vulnerability to cancer later on.
Now, that's a little fatalistic because it leads us to the conclusion that maybe we should starve our children so that they can avoid cancer risk.
Except you don't want to do that because populations are healthier. But what you can do is look at the other side of the energy equation.
Okay.
The other side of the energy equation, we know, you know, the reason why we make more stem cells is a hormone called insulin-like growth factor. And increasing nutrition prenatally and heavier women, we know, give birth to heavier children. Birth weight is linked to many cancers. Heavier weight at birth leads to a high risk of cancer later on, the same reason, more cells. But what happens is as we go on in life and we're inactive and we gain weight and we have progressively higher levels of circulating insulin, the other related insulin hormone, it turns on increased energy intake, it turns on weight gain, it activates many of the growths of cells that take that mutated cell and speed up its rate of growth and increase the risk of developing cancer at an earlier age. So it's the other side of the insulin system, which is, you know, this condition we all deal with, increasing weight gain, inactivity.
Syndrome X, metabolic syndrome.
That's the adult equivalent of what happens when we overfeed children, make them taller. When we overfeed adults, we make them longer, I always say. And that's sort of the really fascinating part of this whole system is it starts prenatally. Its influence is on cell number. And as you get older, its influence is on speeding up the growth of those later initiated mutated cells to make them evolve much more quickly into cancer. So that's really the heart of it. Our children, we don't want to make them shorter because they're not going to be, they may not be as healthy. I mean, that's within the context of population growth. Clearly, if you take animals and you underfeed them, they'll be shorter and they'll have lower cancer risk. We know that. That's very well known. And it's the same factor, this insulin factor. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to do that for population health because we're more robust, we have less heart disease, you know.
More basketball players from China.
Yeah, there you go. Better job market for taller people. Right. They actually do better in the job market even if they don't play basketball.
Yao Ming never would have happened if subject to malnutrition.
Well, my son is just turned 15 and he's 6'3".
Well, there you have it. I mean, it's I look at, sometimes I look at my dad's clothing and his shoes. And, you know, he was an average size guy at 5'8.5", and I'm an average size guy at 5'10.5", and I don't have kids, but you know how it goes, right?
Yeah, and actually, you know, it's very easy to see this because all you have to do is to go into an early colonial home.
Yeah. And you have to
duck between rooms.
Yes, right.
You have to duck, and the average height of the Civil War, most Civil War recruits was 5'4".
Wow.
I mean, we have gained, in the last 100 years, we've gained at least 4 inches in height.
Right.
So people say it's in your genes. Yes, but genes are simply the potential. But what we are able to gain in height, and if you think about the concept, it's one of those, oh, of course, moments when you think the single thing that changes the relationship between cancer, between modern and early times is increasing growth in childhood. And what it does, it means that one out of two children doesn't die. Only 1 in 100 dies. It's a dramatic change in childhood mortality, which really is central
and we don't
to good population
sacrifice
health.
That. But so let's, out of this should grow a modern strategy for cancer prevention, which I think is at the core of your practice. And
right.
What does that consist of?
Well, number one, I look at the things that are, you know, we talk a lot about weight, Ron, and you understand how everybody has been focused on body weight. But I focus more on metabolism because weight is a crude index of your metabolic status.
Right, because you can have, there's actually this term, which is TIFO, I think it is. TIFO,
right.
Thin inside,
right.
Fat out. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Thin outside, fat inside. Which is,
yeah, that's probably in the people's book, but in the medical terminology we call it metabolically obese normal weight.
Yes.
MONW, and those are people who you can tell automatically. You can kind of look at them and they look a little scrawny. They've got very thin limbs. They have a little pot belly, and they turn out to be a really important population because they're often missed. 10% of the population are metabolically abnormal. They have this metabolic syndrome, but they're not really overweight. In fact, they can even be underweight. And one of the things that we have discovered is people on systemic chemotherapy develop this.
Hmm.
They actually, chemotherapy can induce the metabolic syndrome.
Yeah, they're thin, but they have a little pot belly. They get shape.
Yep. Exactly. The other population is elderly. And as we know, metabolic syndrome increases with age, and part of this is a condition called sarcopenia, which is the tendency with inactivity and, you know, poor diet and illness to lose muscle mass over time and gain in fat mass and water weight. And so people become metabolically abnormal, and nobody would even recognize it. I see doctors all the time evaluating people based on their weight or how they look, and they may even miss this. And the converse, which we see a lot of, is very often in women who actually are metabolically completely normal, but their BMI may be 32 or 34. Now, there's a limit where even that body mass is a risk, even if you aren't metabolically abnormal. But there's this clear-cut interest in looking at the outcome of many diseases where people who are metabolically abnormal and yet not overweight may have a higher risk than people who are moderately overweight. This idea of a BMI under 20 or 25, the people who are actually the healthiest are metabolically normal people with a BMI of 25 or 27. That's the fascinating thing. Because if they get sick, they have enough reserve there to help them survive if they can't eat. You know, people who are too thin and get sick or have an accident, have trauma,
yeah.
may actually have a higher mortality.
Yes.
So they
don't have that reserve, yeah. So another word, I mean, translation, we don't want to be rail thin, you know, like
or a real heavy,
like,
right.
like a runway model, you know, when you're in your 70s or 80s, because if you should have a little bit of a, health challenge, you need a cushion. So this has actually been the subject of a lot of discussion lately. The so-called ketogenic diet has been employed in as a proposed way of treating certain types of cancers. I think you're probably aware of the work of Dr. Seyfried, who was looking at not just reduction in carbohydrates, but carbohydrate deprivation in effect to starve the cancers. What do you think of that?
Oh, well, I think enough of it that we're doing it in brain tumor patients ourselves at Yale.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I actually am working with a number of patients, and this is another one of those patient-generated trials where people come to the neuro-oncologist at Smile Cancer Center. The neuro-oncologist sent them to me to help to monitor them and follow them. And the concept is actually there are several reasons why this may or may not work. One is very low-carb diets. Particularly the ketogenic diet, as you know, because it essentially eliminates a high level of glucose and carbohydrates that activate insulin, cause insulin to drop dramatically. Insulin is necessary to generate fat metabolism. It generates, I should say, fat synthesis. And when you turn off insulin, you cause breakdown of fat or lipolysis, and the fat is then converted to ketones. And the ketones provide an alternate source, and the best studies of this originally were in starvation. Starvation ketosis and the ketone bodies became an energy source for cells. And it turns out in what Seyfried is studying in primary brain tumors or glioblastomas, there is some evidence that brain tumors, unlike other cells and even normal glial or brain cells, can actually use ketones for energy, but the brain tumor cells cannot. And so
the healthy cells thrive and the brain tumor cells starve.
That's exactly right. So the brain tumor cells can't use ketones for energy, but the normal brain cells can, and therefore patients seem to be able to do differently. There are a couple of children with astrocytomas who had a prolongation in their survival, and there are numerous studies being done now of ketogenic diets. The real question is, does this form a paradigm for other cancers? Can you use very low-carb diets? And it turns out that the whole idea behind this is a thing called the Warburg effect. The idea that tumor cells are uniquely dependent on high levels of sugar to survive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Glucose.
By the way, and for our listening audience, Warburg published this in the beginnings of the 20th century. I think
that's
he
right.
received a Nobel Prize in like 1910 or something, 1915,
yeah.
something like that.
That's right. And it was really this idea that he discovered in what's called ascites cells. These are cells in the abdominal fluid that they really needed glucose to survive. The problem with the hypothesis is it's very hard to get glucose levels low enough.
Right.
Low enough that you can starve tumors of glucose.
Because you might
really
starve
the
patient first.
Yes, and so you can't, because the patient will go into coma while you're busy trying to kill the tumors.
Right.
And that actually is one of the dilemmas. The other thing is that this turns out not to be, it was thought to be a defect in the cancer cell metabolism, specifically in the energy-making part of the cell, the mitochondria. So there was this theoretical deficiency in which mitochondria didn't completely break down glucose to fuel. And I actually delivered three lectures up in Boston about a month ago on this very topic, because the recent, really fascinating research now in cancer metabolism is really taking hold. There are a large number of groups really studying this area. And it turns out that the idea that this is a defect and only in cancer is actually wrong. It turns out that every rapidly growing cell in the body uses glucose the same way. It uses it and creates extra what's called lactic acid through a process called aerobic glycolysis. I'm going to get into the fancy part of it.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, the idea, why would cells the problem was cells didn't burn all their glucose for energy. That was the concern, and therefore they thought it was abnormal that cells wouldn't burn all their sugar to make energy. They then said it must be, Warburg thought it was inefficient to not burn it all for energy, right? But if you're a carpenter and you have wood, the last thing you want to do when it's cold outside, you take some of the wood for energy and you burn it for heat. But most of the wood you want to save to build a house. And rapidly growing cells save a lot of the glucose to make all the other molecules to build a new cell. And that's really what the Warburg effect turns out to be. It's an adaptation for cell proliferation or growth.
So you rate limit the cells by restricting their building materials, in effect.
That's right, exactly. And what the Warburg effect really turns out to be is something that we see, and there's actually a whole area now of research on studying the Warburg effect in immune cells related to immune deficiencies and immune abnormalities, because they do the same thing. Lymphocytes, the immune cells that make antibodies, make use of the Warburg effect when they're growing.
So, I mean, might this be a way of treating, say, autoimmune diseases or,
possibly.
Like rheumatoid arthritis by limiting the the proliferation of bad immune cells or immune factors in patients who are suffering from autoimmune conditions?
It may. And, my own interest within this whole issue of carbohydrates and cancer is I think actually the heart of this gets back to that one molecule I love, which is insulin.
Yep.
Because it turns out that you can't lower glucose to the point where you have none, but what you can do is dramatically lower the carbohydrate intake, so you can keep insulin levels very low. And it turns out that insulin is one of the key factors that changes cell metabolism. And it also is necessary for cell growth, and so by suppressing insulin, in many cancers you may suppress the growth of the cells. So my focus, getting back to diet and metabolism, abnormal metabolism, high insulin, lowering glucose levels through diet and physical activity, it's turning out that one of the greatest ways to reduce recurrence of cancer is activity.
Yes, because that influences insulin.
Exactly. It's amazing. Much more so even than calorie intake. If you're physically very active, there are many other things it does that are probably beneficial, but it's turning out to be a very important mechanism is suppressing the growth factors like insulin and related growth factors that are critical in speeding up cell growth. And so it may reduce recurrence of breast cancer and colon cancer. There's evidence that men who are more physically active with early prostate cancer have a lower likelihood of what we call PSA recurrence, which is the earliest phase in recurrent prostate cancer. It's truly turning out to be a fascinating way to alter your survival. My own interest is the molecular biology. We can actually look at the genes that are activated or the pattern of activation of genes and find pathways that will determine whether or not you'll actually respond to this. We can actually determine the biology of why people get, don't recur if they're physically active.
What about, to switch gears slightly, if you position yourself as a nutritionally literate doctor and you're up there at Greenwich Hospital, you see a lot of patients in various stages of cancer. Some of them are undergoing chemotherapy, some are undergoing radiation, some are said to be in remission and they just want to prevent recurrence, and many of them are taking boatloads of supplements. This is a very
yes,
controversial area, and many oncologists discourage patients from taking supplements, especially during phases of active treatment. What's your take on that?
I actually take a much more careful approach because there's information to help. I wish I could tell you now that this is the, I told you the interesting cohorts where we follow people over time, Ron.
Yes.
Like the breast cancer study cohorts, I told you about three of them.
Yep.
Two of those studies and the pooling cohort, which looked at all of them together, showed that those women who were taking supplements had a reduction in mortality and recurrence.
Wow. Okay.
Against what we might have thought, but again, it's confounded by behavior. So there may be other things
that
make them
healthier. So they may be more careful patients, the ones
that
take better care of themselves. Right. But
that's interesting. So, I mean, I think that there's a huge debate.
There's not evidence of harm. I mean, I think
right. Exactly. And I was actually interested. I think the thing that I do talk about is a thing called the U-shaped curve, which is really critical to understanding nutrition and physiology in general, that the body is adapted for a relative level, and the dilemma with the idea of boatloads of supplements is it's not normal. And the intriguing area that is still extremely controversial is vitamin D.
Right.
You know, and people are recommending doses that are much higher, much lower. And the people I work with in the School of Public Health, Susan Maines, was on the Food and Nutrition Board, who determined the new guidelines for vitamin D, and they were far lower than
which
people
kind of
expected.
The Institute of Medicine came up with that guideline that said that they didn't think vitamin D was any great shakes for cancer.
Yeah, and they also, well, it was really a little different. They were coming up with the idea of, you know, what should be the standard intake for the population. And so they're like the arbiters of these guidelines. And what they did is they went back and looked at that same kind of long-term study, and they found something interesting. There's a very large group of studies on what's called a pooling cohort of vitamin D and rarer cancers. And this was looked at and published 2 years ago in the American Journal of Epidemiology. And what was really interesting was the level of vitamin D seemed to play no role in risk for most cancers except pancreatic cancer, above the level of what we call 50 nanograms. And that was, depending on which standard you use, is sort of right smack dab in the middle of vitamin D. And those people in that level had a 50% higher risk of pancreatic cancer. Now, that could be because it plays a role, or it could be because people who are developing pancreatic cancer
overaccumulate vitamin D,
exactly.
Yep.
But I think what they were saying was, we just don't know. But there wasn't this, there is a U-shaped curve for vitamin D, and the level at which the risk is optimal is probably what we would now call right in the middle of good vitamin D levels in the current guidelines, which is around 30 nanograms.
Unfortunately, this got translated into alarmist headlines, vitamin D causes pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, and that's exactly the problem. When they actually went back and analyzed this, they turn out not to be the case. But that's the problem. You take these big studies and you misinterpret them. But it does say one thing, which is, we don't know. I always talk about the law of unintended consequences. And so if we take things that are above what is physiologically rational, levels that you can't get spending a lot of time in the sun, and I always say, yeah, you know, X number of minutes in the sun, you generate so much vitamin D. It's worth everybody remembering that the longer you're in the sun, the more adapted you become and the lower the level of vitamin D you produce, because you become, you know, people who spend a lot of time in the sun are deeply tanned.
They aren't continuously producing very high levels. It's only the initiation of
the sun. That's right, exactly. Right. And they actually did a very interesting study in Hawaii looking at people who spend all their time, Caucasians in Hawaii, young people who were skateboarders, not surfers, skateboarders. They didn't use sunscreens, 18 or more hours a week. The average level of vitamin D was what we used to call just above the insufficient range, 26 to 28 nanograms. It wasn't even high.
Interesting.
They weren't taking supplements, but they weren't spending their time indoors. The highest level was 60, which is sort of in the mid-upper range before. And it tells you that the physical levels we normally get when we spend time in the sun are not nearly as really high. So I think we all need to remember, you know, modest amounts, get a healthy diet, remember the U-shaped curve, you know, don't overtake it, because there are multivitamins that have, you know, 10,000% of your daily requirement for a lot of supplements.
Right. What about some of the nutraceuticals that are getting a lot of attention in the cancer field these days? Things like EGCG from green tea, curcumin, resveratrol. Do you have any sense of whether they're going to play a role in prevention or treatment of cancer?
I think they will. I think we're still trying to figure out where. I know Bharat Agrawal from MD Anderson, who's a friend and has done a lot of the work on curcumin. There's a lot of interest, but how do you make it available and how do you get it there and, you know, into the body in adequate levels to have the biological effects it has? The other thing is that when we start to study these, then people start to take them, and then they start to take them in combination. Then they start to take them in many combinations. And one of the interesting things about curcumin is it has a lot of very interesting properties in slowing cell growth of cancer cells. Another compound, ECGC, one of the active metabolites of that, was studied in a disease called chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And these are cells that you can grow in culture and in animals.
Johns Hopkins study or something
like
that. Yeah, right. They're looking at patients with that, CLL.
Right, and here, you know, this particular study was done by Schoenfeld and others at Mayo Clinic.
Okay.
And they did something interesting. They used curcumin and they used a green tea extract individually and together. And what they found was interesting was that either one of them suppressed the growth of the CLL cells. Then they took them and they put them synergistic. In other words, as you use one followed by the other, they reduced it. But if you put them together, they basically antagonized each other and canceled them out.
Huh, interesting.
And so it argues that, you know, until we really understand how these really work in the body, we have to be careful because we can think that we're adding two good things, and it turns out one plus one equals zero, you know?
Right.
And we don't know that because the body, what I love about biology is I know so much less than I realize. And it's always a mystery, and there's always something new to learn.
Absolutely. It is, as you say, the law of unintended consequences.
Exactly.
It is the only immutable law in nature. So general advice to cancer patients, is there such a thing as a cancer preventive diet, or is there such a thing as a diet that prevents cancer from being likely to come back?
I don't, you know, one of the things I don't do, excuse me, I apologize. I cough too much, is one of the things that I really encourage is sort of the Michael Pollan approach, plant-based diet, limit high levels of processed foods. We simply don't know what they do. If you can afford it, organic foods, but if you can't afford it, and for the third of America who can't afford organic food, it's better to eat healthy, you know, whole foods, if you can, vegetables, limit high levels of processed sugar, concentrated carbohydrates, particularly in cancer patients, their biology is different. I really think that limiting high intakes of concentrated carbohydrates, the whites, the high glycemic foods, and even high levels of fruit juices to keep the glucose on the lower end and keep the stimulation of the glucose levels, you know, and the insulin level to a minimum. And physical activity combined with that healthy diet is really critical. There are a few foods I find really interesting, although I'm always complaining about magic foods. One of my favorite foods I have all the time is coffee.
Okay. And there is now evidence about preventive effects in particularly liver cancer with coffee?
Yeah. Well, actually, what's interesting about coffee is in the Scandinavian diet, particularly Norway, it's 60% of the antioxidants in their diet.
Wow.
60%. And one of the things about coffee is it's not a vehicle for caffeine. It's one of the richest sources of phytonutrients because we literally leach out all those great nutrients from the dried bean, and the bean, of course, is what generates the plant. So
even if I drink decaf, which I guzzle all day long, I'm still okay. I'm going to get some.
You're still getting a lot of the benefits. Yeah, and it turns out that it's a 50. There's somebody wrote an article about preventing cancer and the metabolic syndrome, and they had in there all about diet, exercise, and coffee. Coffee was a sub paragraph of that. There was no other single food mentioned but coffee. But I write about this, and because coffee is interesting, and you mentioned about cirrhosis, liver cancer, the way you make liver cancer is to generate in the liver high levels of oxidative radicals that damages the liver cells, causes progressive cirrhosis and fibrosis. Coffee is an incredibly powerful way to inhibit the development of not only cirrhosis, but cancer, liver cancer. In many studies around the world, particularly in Asia where it's common, coffee consumption is directly inversely related to the risk of liver cancer. And it turns out, Ron, that one of the interesting things that they measure coffee's oxidative benefits is it reduces a thing called the ferric reducing ability of plasma. What's that? The ability of iron to oxidize. And when coffee reduces the ability to iron to oxidize, you start to think, wait a minute, one of the most common causes of chronic liver disease is iron overload.
Right. So it reduces the free radical effect of iron
radicals.
That's normally present anyway. So
it's called a Fenton reaction. It drops down the oxidative radical formation from ferric to ferrous or ferrous to ferric. And so it's a fascinating kind of simple food that may be great if you have too much iron in your system.
And you don't need to take it via coffee enema either. You can drink it. It's
no,
okay.
We hope not, yes.
Okay,
that doesn't get to the liver very easily.
That's one of the more radical ways of treating cancer at certain alternative cancer clinics. All right, so the book, The Cancer Recovery Plan, you're busily at work revising it. What's the timetable for that to come out?
Well, probably within the next year, unfortunately, just because of all the other things I'm doing. I do have a blog in the Huffington Post I'm working on, and I have a website, drbarryboyd.com, and in there I have a lot of, try to continue to update that with a newsletter, getting people information about, you know, about the science. Because I think that people are desperate for good information. I'm a little bit of an obsessive, I'm like a dog with a bone. You know, I'm trying to figure out the answer for my patients. That's
where it
comes from.
We're kindred spirits on that.
Amen.
So it's drbarryboyd, B-O-Y-D, .com.
Definitely.
And if you're looking for a physician who is sympathetic to the role of nutrition in your cancer treatment and yet is a mainstream oncologist with ties to the prestigious Yale New Haven health system, you've got Dr. Barry Boyd on your side, and he's located in Greenwich at Greenwich Hospital, a very fine institution. So I thank you for your continued fascination with this field and for illuminating people and for staying open to the role that nutrition may play in not just cancer but a variety of diseases.
Well, stay at it. It's an endless job, but it is very exciting, and we all know how important it is to help people with these questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Barry Boyd, and the website is drbarryboyd.com. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.